crackdowns. In Russia, the Kremlin is going after political enemies. In Ukraine, the government's cracking down on corrupt officials.
Whatever political party you serve or support, if you steal from Ukrainian people, you will go to jail.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, President Trump says ISIS is defeated in Syria, but that is not the whole story.
Yes, we've denied them territory, and that's very, very important. But no, they are not defeated, and we need to keep vigilant.
And Sandra won her human rights in court in Argentina. She's an orangutan. Now she's in Florida. What's that mean for her rights here?
We're not going to solve this in the courts. People have to solve it in their hearts, in their behavior, and, you know, politically, in passing laws.
When animals get human rights. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. The Kremlin is cracking down on some of its most prominent critics. Today, the office of opposition leader Alexei Navalny was raided in Moscow. Police showed up, forced their way into the office, and then confiscated laptops and other equipment.
And this is how they broke down the door.
This is The World's Lucy Martirosyan. What is that noise, Lucy?
So it's some heavy-duty equipment that Russian security officials were using to literally saw through the door of Navalny's office.
Yeah, I was actually in that same office last May. I can picture that very door between the two big conference rooms right now.
Yeah, and sawing through a door sounds intense, but Navalny's group, it's an anti-corruption foundation, they're used to this by now. They're keeping the mood light. They're recording live the entire time via the Periscope app.
Lucy, what is Navalny saying to keep his sense of humor around all this?
So Navalny's like, hey, I'm finally in the office during a raid. So you can tell these raids happen a lot, roughly once a month. And he's just trying to crack jokes. He has a sarcastic tone. Everyone's used to this by now. He's saying, oh, look, over 1,000 people are watching us live. We might as well wish them a happy new year.
Like you said, though, Lucy, this happens all the time for Navalny and his people. What is different this time?
This isn't just another raid. It seems to be a bigger crackdown on Kremlin opposition. Just the other day, we saw one of Navalny's close colleagues shipped off to a remote military base in the Arctic. And Russia does have a draft. You know, this colleague of Navalny, he's 23 years old and well over the age of 18, but he was forcibly conscripted.
Right. I mean, this place sounds a bit like a gulag, not just a military base. It's got some prison-like qualities, hazing by officers, terrible living conditions.
It's not a labor camp, but it's definitely seen as a way to silence political dissent. And by the way, it's not just Navalny's people who are targeted. Just today, in the early morning in Moscow, a journalist's apartment was raided. The newspaper Novaya Gazeta says it was over her investigative work.
So, Lucy, why is all of this happening?
Well, if you ask Alexei Navalny, he says it's over this.
Dmitry Medvedev, премьер-министр и бывший президент России.
It's a video that Navalny's group, that's been labeled foreign agents by the Kremlin, by the way, put out a couple years ago. It went viral in Russia. It has more than 30 million views, and it's over corruption allegations against Russia's prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev.
But this video came out a couple of years ago, so why is this crackdown happening now?
Well, if you look back to the summer, we were seeing huge protests, and that was just over local city elections. The Kremlin is thinking, well, if there were thousands of people taking to the streets over municipal elections, what could happen in 2021 during the parliamentary elections? And so these crackdowns kind of give us the sense that the Kremlin is trying to silence opposition before it gets to a point of even larger protests and demonstrations.
The World's Lucy Martirosyan. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
In the former Soviet Republic of Ukraine, there's a different crackdown playing out. It was a campaign promise by the comedian-turned-president Volodymyr Zelensky. He got elected by vowing to fight corruption. The impeachment process here in the U.S. has distracted from those efforts in Ukraine, but Zelensky and his political allies say they're still trying to root out corruption at all levels of government. And as Levi Bridges reports from the capital, Kiev, one of their targets is a politician with direct ties to Rudy Giuliani.
It might sound like ancient history, But back in 2008, Rudy Giuliani was running for president.
In a world where the next crisis is a moment away, America needs a leader who's ready.
I'm Rudy Giuliani, and I approve this message.
John McCain became the Republican nominee, and Giuliani went back to working as an international consultant. One of his first clients was a towering 6'7" Ukrainian boxer.
The former two-time heavyweight champion of the world, Dr. Iron Fist, Vitaly Klitschko.
Vitaly Klitschko dominated in the ring. But he lost his first bid to become Kyiv's mayor, even with Giuliani's help. And then, years later, Klitschko emerged as a leader in Ukraine's 2014 Maidan Street Revolution that ousted former president Viktor Yanukovych. After the revolution, Klitschko ran for mayor again. This time, he won, vowing to battle corruption.
It's our main challenge, to destroy corruption, to bring the rule of law.
But 5 years later, there's skepticism about whether Klitschko kept that promise. The mayor has been accused of allowing associates to score lucrative construction projects in Kyiv through shady backroom deals. That sort of behavior is exactly what President Trump referred to when he claimed the U.S. should withhold military aid from Ukraine because its leaders can't be trusted. Corruption isn't unique to Ukraine, of course. But Daria Kalinyuk, the executive director of the Anti-Corruption Action Center in Kyiv, says it's a problem that has really persisted in Ukraine because it's been easy for people with money to buy influence in the courts.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union, prosecution office transformed into a supermarket, meaning that there is an official price list, like the price of bribe to be paid to close the case or to open the case.
Kalinyuk says this grocery store judiciary, where you can buy a court ruling just like stopping by the store for a dozen eggs, was perpetuated by politicians.
These oligarchs were investing into politics like startups.
Are you cold? Do you want to walk? We can walk and do this too. Is that better?
Yes.
On a cold gray afternoon near Kyiv's Maidan Square, I meet up with a young guy named Sviatoslav Yurash, who knew Mayor Klitschko during the revolution. Yurash hoped the revolution and emerging leaders like Klitschko would get rid of the old-school political elites. But he's disappointed with Kyiv's mayor.
We want something else than Klitschko in charge of Kyiv.
Yurash isn't just frustrated with Klitschko. He feels like most politicians who took office after the revolution epically failed to change Ukraine.
We expected a fundamental transformation, which was not realized, and that for us is inexcusable, especially after so much sacrifice.
So we thought, I don't have to just sit back and watch.
I'm the youngest ever member of Ukrainian parliament.
How old are you now?
23.
Yurash is a member of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's party, Servant of the People. The party includes a ton of lawmakers with zero political experience. It's all part of the Ukrainian president's Drain the Swamp campaign promise to replace corrupt politicians with a new generation of outsider candidates. One of their first targets, Mayor Klitschko. Earlier this summer, Zelensky's party took steps to remove Klitschko from a second position he holds as head of the Kyiv City State Administration, which would significantly reduce Klitschko's political power.
I haven't yet seen anyone convicted. Anyone in the government?
Leonid Antonenko is a lawyer and member of the Kyiv City Council. He's also the chairman of the city's property commission. Antonenko says time and again, he watched his valuable properties owned by the city were just handed over to folks with ties to Mayor Klitschko for far less than their value.
Once something became vacant, it would very quickly be distributed to the friends of the mayor.
To increase transparency, Antonenko forced the city to release financial information about city properties, who's renting them, how much they're paying. And he developed a map-based website to make that information public. He shows me the map on his phone, and it kind of looks like Airbnb.
You just zoomed in on a map of the city, and there's all these little points.
Right. All those properties are marked here.
Antonenko tells me about one city property, a building registered as a library and museum. But Antonenko says this library is actually being used as a kitchen in a nearby hotel that's owned by the mayor's brother.
As you can see, there is no mark here because it's not transparent.
Meaning all the financial information about this property, there's no public record about that.
You're a member of the public and go to check online, you wouldn't see anything because they selectively choose this information for publication.
How does it make you feel sitting and watching this happen?
Very sad.
Mayor Klitschko declined to be interviewed for this story. After Klitschko's problems started, he flew to New York last July, just 6 days after the now infamous Trump-Ukraine phone call, and met again with Rudy Giuliani, who continues to advise Klitschko informally. In a Facebook post, the mayor called Giuliani his friend and said they'd meet again in Kiev. As an aside, Klitschko has denied that he ever spoke with Giuliani about investigating Joe Biden. President Zelensky's party still hasn't taken the final step to remove Klitschko as head of the Kiev City State Administration. Instead, they've drafted legislation that would introduce more checks and balances on the city government. Daria Kalinyuk, the anti-corruption activist, says it feels like there's real change in the air.
I think we are close to sending a very clear message to corrupt elites in Ukraine. Listen, guys, whoever you are, whatever post you hold, in whatever political party you serve or support, if you steal from Ukrainian people, you will go to jail.
Kalinyuk says all the instances of corruption we hear about in Ukraine these days, that's actually a good thing. It means wrongdoing is finally being exposed, and that Ukraine is becoming a freer country where people can speak out about abuses of power. In that sense, the corruption allegations against politicians like Mayor Klitschko aren't warning signs of a country moving backwards. They're actually signs of progress. For the world, Levi Bridges, Kyiv.
If you hear the phrase ring of fire, you may think of the chain of fiery volcanoes that ring the Pacific Ocean, if you're a geography buff. News consumers might have heard the description of a ring of fire wildfires around the Australian city of Sydney. There's also another meaning. This was the moment in Singapore today when a ring of fire appeared in the sky. It's kind of a solar eclipse. The moon blocks the sun, but the moon is far away enough from planet Earth that it does not completely eclipse the sun, leaving an unreal golden ring of sunlight. Dirk Gordenstein is a German living in Dubai and caught the first moments of the eclipse on its path from west to east. This was not his first eclipse, but...
First time I've seen the ring as such, which was amazing experience. And the ring was amazing, like, yeah, ring of fire. And it's a very nice experience.
Vic from India is also a young resident of Dubai. He traveled 2 hours across the desert before dawn for one reason.
I wanted to come here only to witness this once-in-a-lifetime moment. And it looks so amazing while you see it. It's like it's completely covered.
It's an exciting moment, as you can hear. But as I said, today's event was an annular eclipse, and the sun is only partially blocked by the moon. The ring of fire can be seen somewhere on Earth every year or two. I can assure you, though, it does feel like a once-in-a-lifetime experience. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. More than 90% of the Philippines is Christian, which means terrible storms have made for a rough Christmas for thousands of people in the central part of the country. Typhoon Panfon ripped through the area, killing at least 20 people and stranding thousands more. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Authorities are still assessing the extent of the damage. The typhoon made landfall on Christmas Eve and destroyed homes, flooded villages, caused landslides, and left an entire province with no electricity. Richard Gordon is with the Red Cross in the Philippines. He says the storm seemed to come out of nowhere.
It came like a thief in the night. Everybody was already getting ready to celebrate Christmas. And all of a sudden, you have tremendous winds blowing, a lot of rain in some areas that caused severe flooding, and certainly a lot of roofs collapsed.
Officials said most of the deaths were caused by drowning, falling trees, and electrocution, and many people are still missing. The storm also stranded tens of thousands of travelers who were trying to go home to see their families over Christmas. Ana Karina Arcio is a journalist with the news website Rappler.
The Philippine Coast Guard has been helping out the stranded passengers in ports. They've been distributing food also as well. But of course, there's only so much you can do when you're stranded at the port for, let's say, 2 days. And it's, of course, heartbreaking for them not to be at home in the provinces with their families spending the Christmas holidays.
The Philippines gets hit by an average of 20 typhoons a year. But Richard Gordon of the Red Cross says more and more there's the sense that these storms can happen at any time.
The unusual thing about this is that we're being hit when the typhoons are supposed to be gone. Before, they never went beyond November. We've had several typhoons hitting us in December, some in January, even February. So it really is a weird thing that now we have to expect typhoons at all months of the year.
Typhoon Panfan got weaker today, but meteorologists are still concerned about where it goes next. One computer model shows the storm moving into southern China and eastern and northern parts of Vietnam. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
It's no secret, across the world, many governments face accusations of human rights violations. Yes, the United States, too. And activists continue to fight back. When it comes to animals, there's also a movement to fight for their rights. The World's Rupa Shenoy has this story that we featured in our podcast. It's about an orangutan that has emerged as a symbol of the animal rights movement.
For years, people said Sandra looked depressed. She'd sit outside in the rain and snow, her shaggy red hair damp and matted. She neglected Max, who was supposed to be her mate. Visitors to the Buenos Aires Zoo said Sandra seemed lonely, even though orangutans usually prefer to be solitary, high in the trees. Activists worried Sandra's accommodations were inadequate. They sued.
A court in Argentina is to rule on whether an allegedly depressed orangutan named Sandra is entitled to certain human rights.
In 2015, a judge in Argentina made international news by declaring Sandra a non-human person and sentient being with legal rights. Her attorney, Andrés Gil Domínguez, said the ruling would influence other cases and spread the idea that confinement violates sentient animals' rights. Since then, a chimpanzee named Cecilia has also been declared a non-human person in Argentina. A court in Colombia has recognized the legal rights of a bear named Chucho. That's surprising, considering courts have only been hearing cases like this for a few years, says Matthew Liebman of the Animal Legal Defense Fund.
The animal law movement really grew out of the United States, but the most remarkable progress we've seen has been outside of the United States, with things like the Sandra case in South America.
Yet nothing changed for Sandra for years. She was still stuck in the Buenos Aires Zoo.
We did not solicit having her come here because I didn't think it was possible.
Patty Reagan founded the Center for Great Apes in Florida. It has more than 60 orangutan and chimpanzee refugees from circuses or people's former pets, including Bubbles, who belonged to Michael Jackson.
We are the only orangutan sanctuary that is accredited in North and South America.
But Reagan knew it would be a huge process to meet U.S. requirements to get Sandra into the country. Still, Sandra didn't have many options. Orangutans are highly endangered. Their forest habitats in Indonesia are disappearing. And Sandra never lived in the wild. Plus, she's a hybrid of two orangutan species. And Indonesia has banned orangutans like her from its sanctuaries.
After looking at several options for Sandra, around the world, actually, they asked us again to please take her.
Now, at 33 years old, Sandra has finally arrived home.
She walked into her room. She was just engaged and interested, very calm, foraged around for food in the hay and got some blankets, went up and made a nest that night and slept well.
Sounds like a happy ending, right? For some animal rights activists, though, there's still a lingering question.
The question is, if she was a person in Argentina, does that mean she's a person within the United States?
Stephen Wise says no one knows yet. He's head of the nonprofit Non-Human Rights Project, currently teaching animal rights jurisprudence at Tel Aviv University, and he's fighting for personhood for animals in several cases. He hopes bringing up Sandra's case will help sway judges, even if it doesn't serve officially as a precedent.
We're not saying that they're bound by that. We're simply saying that the world is changing outside of your courtroom and you may want to change with it.
So far, American judges haven't been persuaded by Weiss's arguments. Kristen Stilt is director of the Animal Law and Policy Program at Harvard Law.
you almost get a sense that judges are really looking for reasons not to do what he's asking. One of the reasons, which is, well, they're just being transferred to another form of captivity. They're not being freely released.
Judges may make a different decision if public attitude shifts, she says. And that's why other activists say Sandra is most important as a symbol.
If we care about Sandra, why don't we care about all of them?
Marianne Sullivan is a lecturer in animal law at Columbia Law School and co-host of the Animal Law Podcast. She points out that these court cases only apply to individual animals, not animals as a class.
Animals live and die in hidden factory farms and hidden laboratories. They're not going to court. So, yeah, we're not going to solve this in the courts. People have to solve it in their hearts, in their behavior, and, you know, politically in passing laws.
As for Sandra, the orangutan, for the first time in her life, no one's watching. She's exploring an aerial network of tunnels at the Center for Great Apes and hanging out in her own heated and cooled indoor and outdoor spaces. Director Patty Reagan says that lifestyle costs about $20,000 a year. The center's funded by donations and grants and isn't open to the public. Reagan also says Sandra doesn't have to worry about being pushed into mating.
We don't breed because to raise another baby just to be in captivity is really, you know, is not the right thing to do.
But there is an orangutan Reagan hopes Sandra might be interested in.
One that I would love to see her like, if she so chooses, Jethro, very sweet, quiet male, but if she doesn't like him, we have other males and females that she may enjoy living with.
If she does like Jethro, though, Sandra should know. He's had a female companion for years, but
he's interested in a younger male right now.
Turns out, things get complicated when apes have rights and choices. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
You can catch a glimpse of Sandra the orangutan in her new home that comes equipped with a kiddie pool. She also has a human right to splash. That's at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Let's go back to Antarctica, shall we, with a group of scientists who got some help from the locals. Elephant seals providing crucial data on climate research. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. A wildfire that began on Christmas Eve in the Chilean city of Valparaiso was still burning today. It has destroyed many houses, leaving many people homeless. Here's how one man described the impact of the fires on his family.
I lived over there and the house was burnt. My cousins, uncles and aunts, our extended family is now out on the street. I was born here. My siblings grew up here. Everything is destroyed.
Authorities say the fires were probably started intentionally. Police are urging people with information to come forward. The coastal city of Valparaiso was placed on red alert due to expected high temperatures over the next couple of days. Jane Chambers is a reporter based in Chile. She's been following the story closely and joined us from Ritoque, a town about 40 miles up the coast from Valparaiso.
I'm sitting at the moment in a lookout, looking out across the sea, and I can see Valparaiso in the distance.
This is kind of like a terrible holiday moment because these fires have been going on several days now. What's the current update on the status of the fires?
Yes, it is very sad. So around 245 houses have been completely burnt down. And one has to remember that these are very little, almost like shacks, and they're generally made of wood. So it was very easy for the blaze just to rip right through them. And there have been many people left completely destitute. At the moment, many of them, around 1,000 people are saying, are taking shelter with friends and family. And they've been going back to look at their houses to see if they can salvage anything. But most of it has been completely destroyed.
Yeah. And what about the fires themselves? Are they still burning?
They seem to think that the blaze is pretty much under control now. It might be minimal, but not half as strong as it was. I'm actually staying about an hour away from Valparaiso on the coast, so I could see the smoke. It was very, very thick smoke. And I have family that live in Viña del Mar, which is literally the town next door to Valparaiso. And they had ash coming down onto them. So they were very wow. strong fires. They started in a kind of forest area on the outskirts of Valparaiso and then just ripped right through these two neighborhoods on the hills. It was very hard for the firefighters to get to them because often it's very, very steep. About 12 of them have been injured, but it's been made harder because it's really hot at the moment, high temperatures and high winds. So there's a worry that there might be fresh fires or the fire might come back again.
Right. Of course, it's summer down there below the equator in Chile. So aside from the firefighters, any other casualties?
No, luckily not at the moment. I mean, one has to remember that Valparaiso is no stranger to fires. They had a very, very bad fire back in 2014 where I think around 12 or 13 people actually died, which was incredibly sad. For the moment, the firefighters have been injured, but no casualties.
Are the firefighters in Valparaiso volunteers or are they public employees?
This is one of the interesting things about Chile. Firefighters are volunteers and people are often asked to give money and they're often attached to the different immigrant communities. So it's tough. They lack resources, especially at this time of year when temperatures are so high and fires are so frequent.
The mayor of Valparaiso, Jorge Sharp, said there were indications that the fires were started intentionally. Is this believed to be arson or some kind of negligence?
They're looking into it, they're investigating. But often these fires are started by negligence because you have these high temperatures. If someone just even drops a cigarette end or in Chile, barbecues are very, very popular. So, you know, embers from that. So at the moment, it's difficult to tell, but they're certainly talking about the fact that these fires may well have been started on purpose.
So, Jane, you've given us a couple of glimmers into Valparaiso, kind of a steep city. It's on the coast. What more can you tell us about it?
Well, it's a very popular tourist destination. It's got these hills with brightly coloured, pretty houses, and many tourists flock there. But at the moment, Chile's in a difficult situation. There's social unrest because of inequality. And this unrest has been going on since the end of October. And there's been a lot of looting in Santiago, the capital, but also in Valparaiso. I was there just a couple of weeks ago. And restaurants, you know, where in summer, as you say, high season, these restaurants should be absolutely full. This is when they make their money, but they're empty. And people are very, very worried. And these businesses, hotels, restaurants, hostels, they're going to go under if the tourists don't go there. So with the social unrest and the fires, things are very difficult for Valparaiso.
Jane Chambers, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Jane Chambers there. She's a reporter based in Chile. We're going back to Antarctica now, where gigantic glaciers reach out from the continent and into the ocean. Those glaciers are melting from below because of a layer of warm water. That melting could raise sea levels and change coastlines around the world. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler joined scientists studying that glacier on a research expedition earlier this year, and we've been revisiting her trip all this week. The scientists she followed used all kinds of tools to study the ocean water that's melting the glaciers. That included getting some help from seals. Here again is Carolyn Beeler.
Just off the west coast of Antarctica, a very big elephant seal is hauled out on a very small island. He's about 1,500 pounds, the length of a small car, and he smells like hot garbage. Ecologist Lars Buma is standing face-to-face with the seal on the rocky beach. He's eyeing his jowls and bulbous nose to see if he's finished shedding his fur yet.
So I want to look at the head, at the underside of the neck.
When the seal bellows, his hot breath hits Lars in the face.
You hear the amount of air going in and out.
Lars works for the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He and three other scientists are out here hoping to attach sensors to seals to track the ocean's temperature as they dive.
So when the seal comes back to the surface, the data is transmitted in real time back to a ground station back home.
This data will teach scientists about the seals themselves and help them learn how fast warm water is melting West Antarctica's glaciers. A melting that could change the shape of our coastlines forever.
That means that in the winter, when it's minus 40 degrees, pitch dark, we get data from below the sea ice, and we don't have to be here, which is quite nice.
Still molting on the head as well. still very fat. He needs another 2 weeks.
Turns out this seal hasn't finished molting yet. If Lars put a sensor on him, it'd just fall off with his old fur. So he finds another candidate, a smaller, sleek Weddell seal, about 100 feet down the beach.
The head is molted, so we want to put a tag on.
But first, Lars has to catch the 650-pound animal.
So we catch it in a net. It will move. We will move. After a couple of minutes, everybody is exhausted, and the seal will settle down.
That net is more like a giant canvas bag with ropes for handles. Lars and another scientist grab it and try to slide it over the seal's head. He looks up at them and twists around. After a few minutes of this strange dance, the scientists get the bag over the seal's head to subdue him and inject him with anesthesia. Lars says this doesn't hurt the seals, and the sensors don't impact their mating or survival. I'm actually struck by how tenderly he and his colleague Guy Bortoloto treat the animal as they kneel beside him in their neon orange snowsuits.
I don't know, I like to think that they are our allies on this.
This kind of seal dives about a quarter of a mile underwater. That's right around where a layer of warm water that's melting the glaciers of West Antarctica starts.
Every time I see and think about these guys helping us, I think like how lucky we are that the biology of them fits perfectly to fill the gaps that we need, like of data.
With the seal under anesthesia, Lars glues the sensor to the back of his head. It's about the size of a smartphone and a couple inches thick with an antenna that looks like a unicorn horn. After about half an hour, the seal starts to come to and he shakes a little bit.
It's a side effect of the drug.
But Lars says the seal is fine.
I will just sit in front just in case that even the drug stayed, he's not going for the water.
Lars keeps an eye on the seal until it's safe for him to slide off the ice at the edge of the island and swim away. It's weird to see this and think about how differently we used to treat seals down here 200 years ago.
Men who were going to hunt the seals were dropped off on the islands with clubs and knives.
This is Beth Moore, the curator at the Nathaniel B. Palmer House in Connecticut. Palmer's the guy who the ship that took me to Antarctica was named after. He was a sealer, and sealers in the 1800s used to club southern fur seals to death to avoid damaging their silky pelts.
If the clubbing didn't work, they would then pull out some long knives and pierce them, being careful not to tear at the fur.
Demand for this fur was so high that by the early 1800s, more accessible seal colonies had already been wiped out.
Every year, they were having to go further and further south in the South Atlantic to find the seal breeding grounds.
Sealers nearly wiped out the entire population of southern fur seals during the 1800s. On some islands, it would take them more than a century to rebound.
I didn't realize the seals.
Back on the ship, the Nathaniel B. Palmer, Lars Bouma shows me what his seals have been up to. He attached sensors to a dozen of them over several long days in the field.
I have a main page here, which is a very simple
Lars pulls
page.
Up a map on his phone. It shows the near real-time paths of his seals. They shoot out in different colors like fireworks from the islands where he found them.
For example, this is a Weddell seal. We were talking about that.
He shows me the temperature data from her dives.
And you see blue is cold water, red is warm water. This seal really dove into the circumpolar deep water, into the warm water that's at greater depth.
This layer of warmer water has long existed in the deep ocean, but now it's being forced up toward Antarctica. Scientists think changing winds are to blame and may be linked to climate change, but they need more data to know for sure. Data like what the seals are gathering. Today, seals in Antarctica are protected under international treaty. Lars had to get permits and go through ethical reviews to work with them.
I try to treat them like humans. They have their own life, they have families. It is a big ethical question.
This, of course, marks a big shift in our relationship with nature since the days of Nathaniel B. Palmer.
We always thought of the ocean as being this unlimited resource, and hunting seals was part of it. And more recently, we discovered it's not an unlimited resource, and we really have to take care of it.
Lars hopes the more precise sea level rise predictions coming out of this research will help give us a better sense of the larger changes we're causing in the natural world.
understanding the melting, the potential sea level rise really helps us to better protect ourselves and all ecosystems.
The seals Lars tagged will swim around through the Antarctic winter, collecting data until their sensors fall off during their next molt. For The World, Carolyn Beeler.
Carolyn reported that story earlier this year and joins me now with an update. So, Carolyn, the long, dark Antarctic winter, it's over. Their summer is just starting now. What have those seals been up to since you last saw them?
So I was curious about just the same thing. So I called up Lars last week.
Hello?
Hi, Lars.
Oh, hello. Oh, you're very loud. Wait.
And he told me that the seals he and his team tagged actually stayed pretty close to home.
So if you think about the Amundsen Sea, it's like a V.
They all stayed pretty close to the eastern edge of the sea.
They essentially moved only about 20 miles, 30 miles. So they stayed very close to the coastline, happily feeding away, diving when it's 100% ice cover. But they always find a little crack in the ice, come up to the surface, we get our data, and then they dive again. The funny
so
thing,
all last spring and summer and into early fall, Lars and his colleague were checking on them. They were cracking open their laptops back home in Scotland to see where these seals were going.
Guy and I were looking up the webpage every day, what the seals were up to, where they were going, how deep they were diving. And did that until this morning.
They've recorded more than 63,000 dives and 4,500 of these temperature and salinity profiles that tell us about the water they're diving down into.
So cool that they're tracking these seals up in Scotland. So are they still getting fresh data?
So most of the tags stopped transmitting early this fall. That's what they're designed to do, except for one.
So the last seal is still transmitting, the elephant seal, at the moment.
Lars and Guy haven't started analyzing this data yet because it's not all in just yet, but it should be in about a month.
So that in a month's time, when we go on the next trip, we should have our data from last year. It's a long process.
And that one elephant seal that's still transmitting, where is it right now?
So you're going to love this, Marco. The elephant seal, she dove around the coast just like the Weddell seals, the smaller ones, most of the summer and the fall.
So there was no difference in movement.
Until about mid-November.
In mid-November, the seal, she decided, oh, I'm pregnant. I have to have my pup. And then within 25 days or something like that, she moved all the way back to Livingston Island. So 1,500 miles. And she is there since the 4th of December on land. So we think she's having a pup.
Aww.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we hope so. And
yeah, Mama Seal's got to nurture, right?
Yeah, she'll be on the island nursing for another couple of weeks before she heads back into the ocean.
So you mentioned they're still getting data from these seals, but no official results yet. Are there any early conclusions, though, that they can draw about Thwaites Glacier?
So Lars does think they're going to be able to get some good data from these seals. They did dive down into this layer of circumpolar deep water that's melting Thwaites Glacier. And the data that they've gathered, combined with data from other instruments on the ship, has told scientists more about how this warm water gets up onto the continental shelf toward Antarctica. None of that's published yet. Bigger picture, the information that has come out about Thwaites over the past year, none of it has been great news. New data published this summer shows that the melt rate on the West Antarctic ice sheet is only increasing. And largely because of information like that, the UN's climate change panel recently revised its predictions for sea level rise for the end of the century. So we're still waiting on the data from the Thwaites crews. But so far, none of the news we're seeing coming out about Thwaites is good news.
The World's Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
For a look at those seals, come over to our website, theworld.org. Donald Trump came into office pledging no more endless wars, but he has twice tried to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, and twice he sent them back in. And of course, the conflict in Afghanistan is dragging on. So as we prepare to enter a new decade, we're going to take a moment to review both conflicts. And who better to help us than Michelle Flournoy? Flournoy was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Barack Obama. She now runs a strategic consulting firm called West Exec Advisors in Washington. We began by talking about the fight against ISIS in Syria.
Clearly, the success we've had in denying them territory in Syria, the raid that killed Baghdadi, these are big victories. But ISIS has not gone away. It has sent fighters to find safe haven in other places, whether it's Afghanistan or Libya and so forth. And they are very strong online. They're still able to recruit lone wolves. They're trying in Europe and they're trying in the United States and elsewhere to launch attacks. So, you know, yes, we've denied them territory, and that's very, very important. But no, they are not defeated, and we need to keep vigilant.
Didn't Donald Trump inherit a pretty incoherent policy on Syria to begin with? I mean, Obama had numerous missteps going back to the red line on chemical weapons, not being tough enough on Assad. Didn't they kind of have to start at zero, Trump and his team?
They did not. President Obama had actually succeeded in building a very robust counter-ISIS coalition with dozens of countries involved, including many of our NATO allies and our Gulf partners. And the counter-ISIS campaign, working with the Kurds and others, was actually quite successful and then continued to be successful under the Trump administration because they didn't change much. We can have a debate about whether the larger Syria policy was successful, and I would argue it wasn't. You basically have a situation where Russia intervened, regained a foothold in the Middle East, and Assad is going to stay in power despite having murdered thousands and thousands of his own citizens and displaced millions.
So we've just seen this trove of documents, the Afghanistan papers, basically detailing how for the last 18 years, the American public was at times told a different story, a rosier story about the war in Afghanistan, at times was just blatantly lied to. Are we going to see the same kind of documents or revelations about Syria, say, in 10 years?
There was a lot of internal debate about what was working and what was not working in Afghanistan. But I can think of no person who was willfully manipulating the information or lying to the president or the American people. I think people
we were being told
that
American
we were
people
being
were
more
being
successful.
Told that progress was being made in Afghanistan and clearly was not.
Well, but I think there were people who believed that progress was being made, and they may have been wrong. They may have been measuring the wrong things, and they may have been faulty in their analysis. But I don't think, you know, a lot of that came from military reporting in the field about success from the surge. I don't think those people were willfully lying.
Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld admitted, and he's quoted, that he didn't know who the enemy was at one point.
Maybe I should be clear. My experience was in the Obama administration. I did not encounter people willfully lying. I don't know what happened in the Bush administration in terms of whether Rumsfeld actually lied or others were being he was being lied to. But during my time in the Obama period, we tried to be very clear-eyed. There was a huge debate with interagency about whether we were succeeding or not. This is I think the value of the papers is to have us take a hard lessons learned look at, you know, how do we avoid the mistakes? We made a lot of mistakes. How do we avoid those mistakes in the future? How do we learn from those? But I think it sort of muddies the water to ascribe ill intent, at least to the folks that I saw really trying hard to get this right and often failing, but trying hard to get it right during the Obama administration.
There was a recent poll conducted by the Military Times, a U.S. Armed Forces publication, that shows that 58% of the troops polled said they disapproved of the president's decision to withdraw troops from Syria, a move that, as you said, was exploited by Russia and Turkey, and the U.S. turning its back on Kurdish forces allied with the U.S. Has the abandonment of the Kurds, do you think, shaken the U.S. military on some fundamental level?
I think it has. I mean, one of the core values that you learn and you adopt as a member of the military is you don't abandon the person on your right or your left on the battlefield. You don't abandon an ally who is sacrificing alongside you, is spilling blood alongside you. And that's exactly what we did to the Kurds. And so it's deeply offensive. I had one officer describe to me that made him feel nauseous, that he was so upset about it, and that he worried that in the future, you know, allies won't trust us to have their backs. And that's always been a huge source of strategic strength for the United States. We have dozens and dozens of allies who've been willing to fight alongside us, and China doesn't, Russia doesn't, Iran doesn't, North Korea doesn't. So we're undermining our own advantage when we mistreat our allies.
What would it take to get the U.S. on solid footing in terms of policy in Syria?
Well, at this point, I think we have a very weak hand to play. I don't think we have the position or the leverage to determine the ultimate outcome. I do think the U.S. should be diplomatically more engaged in trying to shape whatever outcome is negotiated among the parties. And I do think we want to keep our focus on the counter-ISIS campaign and supporting our Kurdish and Syrian Democratic Forces allies on the ground.
Michelle Flournoy, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and co-founder and managing partner of West Exec Advisors. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We had a tough choice to make with all the great music released in 2019, but narrow it down we must. Making our top 10 was this release from Welsh singer-songwriter Gruff Rhys, formerly with the band Super Furry Animals. Here's the title track from his solo album, Pang.
Pang o hiraeth, pang o fyrraeth, pang o iawgrwydd, pang o gwylydd, pam dyfaru, pam yn llipio, cam ddefnyddio, grym a'i peidio, pang o iawgrwydd.
Title track from Welsh musician Gruff Rhys's album Pang. You can find our top 10 list of albums released this year at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, thanks for listening today. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Pam dehongli, achrysoli, pam bodoli.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.